May it please the court, good morning again, justices, counsel. My name is Simon Purnell. I do represent the appellant who's with me today, Mr. Michael Newman, individually and on behalf of, derivatively on behalf of the Rockport Area Association of Realtors. Also with me is my son, Gareth Purnell, who's anxiously waiting his bar results. Although under my license, I think he arguably could have argued today.
You could have.
Anyway, this appeal it arises from the denial of a TCPA anti-SLAPP motion that we filed. Procedurally, just to quickly give you some background, there was a declaratory action that was filed. In response to the declaratory action, we received, you know, the answer and then a counterclaim. That counterclaim sounded in defamation. We filed the motion because we believe that the TCPA, number one, applied, and that the facts that exist would not support the necessary defamation elements that need to be proved out. So just to understand sort of where we were, is I filed the motion of, you know, the response was filed, we filed a reply, and then we actually had the hearing on it. Judge Bauer denied the motion. It was a very simple order, as denying the motion and granting attorney's fees to the respondent, which we have a problem with as well. Because it is sort of this generalized denial, it's not entirely clear what happened, why she denied it. So I feel like I need to address, you know, the steps of a TCPA in order to fight back on this. And so let me just start there. You know, the TCPA, I know the court is very aware of it. You've addressed it a number of different times. Basically begins with, well, does this thing apply? Does the action that's being complained of apply, or have the TCPA sort of rest upon it? That's step one. So the determination needs to be made, is this the kind of thing that the TCPA applies to? If it does, and the burden is on the plaintiff, or I suppose not the plaintiff, is on the person who actually files the motion. It's their burden to show that it actually applies. If it does, in fact, apply, then the burden shifts over to the respondent, and the respondent is the appellee here. And they have to show by clear and specific evidence, the prima facie case of defamation in this case. They would have to go through each and every one of the elements and provide prima facie or the clear and specific evidence of each and every one of those elements. We don't believe they did. So let me just...
Let's take a step even further back. As we're reviewing this order by this trial judge, we're reviewing that order de novo.
Correct.
Are we not? So it's we can decide, whatever the trial court decided becomes somewhat irrelevant if they decided, for example, that they didn't meet the first burden or you didn't meet the second burden, because we'll have to ascertain that all three are met in order as to whether it applied or did not apply.
That is correct.
Okay. So let's talk about the first one, because we had a discussion this morning as to whether it applies to this association that's before us, this Rockport Area Association of Realtors. Does the anti-SLAPP actually apply to this type of organization as it's defined under the statute?
I believe it does, and let me explain why.
Okay.
There are three different ways that the TCPA operates. It's protecting the freedom of speech, it's protecting the right of association, and then there's the right of petition. The right of petition does not carry with it this additional element that seems to be in the statute, requiring it, you know, requiring that it's a matter of public concern. I mean, that's the magic sort of phrase. So
is that the one where you think it falls in under a matter of public concern?
It would. It does.
Be excluded from some others.
Yes, I believe it would if we're only talking about the freedom of speech and the right of association. But we also believe that this was in response to the DEC action that was filed against the Rockport Area Association of Realtors. in that case, it wouldn't have to be a matter of public concern. It's simply, it's related to his right of petition. The right of petition does not carry with it this idea of it needing to be a matter of public concern. But either way, the matter of public concern, then, you know, the statute tells us what it is. It basically says that it's 27.0017. There are all these definitions in there. But if you go to 27.0017, it defines a statement as an activity regarding a public official. I think we can toss that aside. B, a matter of political, social, or other interest in the community. I think that covers what the Rockport Area Association of Realtors does. And C, oddly, the definitions that our legislature gives us are just remarkable sometimes. A subject
it makes,
of concern.
It makes a lot of work for us.
Yes.
The legislature makes work for us every day.
A subject of concern to the public. So they just flip the words around, which I believe it is. And let me tell you why I think it is. The communications that are complained of in the defamation claim are regarding the Rockport Area Association of Realtors. So what is the Rockport Area Association of Realtors? Is what they do a matter of public concern, and are the communications related to what the Rockport Area Association of Realtors does? I think the simplest way to look at it, because there isn't a lot of evidence about what the Rockport Area Association of Realtors is other than what we see in you know, the emails and some of the forming documents of the association, which is kind of where I hone in on. So when they were formed back in 1978, and then most recently in 2021, they amended their sort of articles, they have some statements in there that are in the record. The organization has these public filings, and they say they have this section called objectives. And the objectives are to unite those engaged in the recognized branches of the real estate profession for the purpose of, and this is the important part, exerting a beneficial influence upon the profession and related interests. So if we're only looking at just the professionals themselves that are involved in the Rockport Area Association of Realtors, I think that's a matter of public concern, limited to whoever's involved in that area, in the real estate community, so to speak. But it goes even further. It says to provide a unified medium for real estate owners and those engaged in the real estate profession whereby their interests may be safeguarded and advanced. It goes further to say, to further the interests of home and other real property ownership. And then finally, to designate for the benefit of the public those individuals authorized to use the term realtor. So that's in the record. It's pages 45 and 46. If you'd like to look at that, but their stated purpose is to benefit the community. It's to benefit homeownership and other real estate, real estate ownership. I mean, if homeownership and its related activities are not a matter of public concern, I literally don't know what is. So that alone, I think, gets us there. The organization does those things. So
are the emails derivative of that? So because that's then are we dealing with something that deals with the association and derivative as we look at what was alleged in the petition?
Yes. So the emails are directed by Mr. Newman at the executive board of the Rockport Area Association of Realtors. There are three generalized categories of those emails, and there's a number of them. They're kind of like these newsletter/emails, but one of them, one little subsection, is talking about the MLS. So the MLS is the service that they use. And he's complaining of the fact that they're not expanding into a more regional version of the MLS, which would assist the realtors in doing their jobs and promoting the interests of the Rockport Area Association of Realtors in some form, but primarily promoting their business and assisting the homeownership in the area. The second, or another category of emails are regarding the finances of the Rockport Area Association of Realtors. I think you could argue that really when you have an organization like this, a not-for-profit organization that focuses on this type of stuff, which is, they've already stated it, what their purpose is, you could probably get down to what type of pencils they decide to use in board meetings and say it's related to this public purpose that they have. But that's not really what we have here. What we have is the way they're managing the organization, with the way they're applying their finances and having their membership sort of complain about it, and then they get sort of, you know, sued because apparently they're talking
about
it.
Well, we know that in certain circumstances, in other organizations like economic development corporations, that the finances of those have been found to be under this type of circumstances, has been found to be under this statute. But my concern here is that this is more, you know, private dues. We're not dealing with, you know, grant money or federal government or tax money. These are dues. No one requires them to pay dues to be part of this organization in order to mandate them to do their job. So why does that become public concerns? I mean, if you don't like what they're doing with your money, don't pay your dues and don't be part of the association. So doesn't that take it out of the statute?
I don't believe it does. And I understand the distinction if we were talking about something relatively small. And I don't know if there's a bright line out there that suggests that you have a very small board that's running, you know, a ballet studio or something like that. I don't think those... I don't even know that the line gets drawn there. But in this case, what we're talking about, yes, the dues that go into the Rockport Area Association of Realtors and how they choose to spend it. But what he's talking about is this, it kind of flows over into the MLS, because that's part of what the complaint is that they're not spending their money well and making decisions to use a more limited version of the MLS and not allowing for the expansion, which... goes to the purpose, which is to, you know, assist these realtors in assisting, you know, their clients in the general home ownership or property ownership in the area.
Can I so if the Rockport Area Realtors Association would be subject to anti-SLAPP motions, how far do you take that with trade organizations? I know you talked about there's probably not a right line rule, but there's a lot of trade organizations that are promoting their trades in order to benefit their members. I know home ownership is close to everyone's heart because it's, everyone wants a home, but we might not be as concerned as with an organization that is simply organized to benefit the members economically. So is this going to open it up for every private trade organization?
Can you
point us to... some case law that identifies an organization similar to this one where the anti-SLAPP was used?
So there are a number of cases that have addressed it that are in these not-for-profit type, in the not-for-profit sort of context. There's the Police Officers Association case, and a guy, I just don't have it up on top of my head, but I believe it's been briefed, that did allow it to happen. Because it was sort of outwardly facing, and to use opposing counsel's term, police officers are pretty important. They do a service to the community, that kind of stuff. I think this case is similar to that, primarily because of their stated objective, which is to influence home ownership in some form or fashion, and to really protect it and just make it. I mean, that's their stated objective right up at the front of their papers. And they exercise a lot of control, if not all of it, with the regard to the realtors who are involved over in that area. Because without it, if you're not a member of it, you're going to have some difficulty, you know, doing what you do over there, being a realtor over there, which is... Anyway, I won't get into the details of that. But so to answer your question, I don't think that this case expands the TCPA in any way, shape, or form. I think it gives us sort of almost a rule where you do have an organization that is sort of a trade organization. I don't know if we're going to be expanding the statute or maybe limiting it by saying an organization, a trade organization, that benefits the community and not only its members. But I think this, if that was a rule, we would fit under it, even under that limited view or limited interpretation. I do think, though, that trade organizations, generally speaking, should be considered to have a public purpose, even if it is for the limited, you know, trade that one is in and that you chose to join into it. I mean, it's more than just one guy, you know, knocking another guy over something. I mean, this is the definition of the organization and the membership, I think, becomes important. Like, who is actually benefiting from this trade organization? Here, I think there's two very different reasons why it would be that sort of public purpose. And one of them, of course, is what I've already stated, their stated objectives. But the other is that, you know, they serve a community of people. And that community are the realtors that join it because they want to do their business over in the Rockport area. So I think that's incredibly important.
You're out of time, so I'm going to let you wrap it up real quick. You still have your 5 minutes of rebuttal.
I do, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. For those reasons, Judge, I really do, Justices, I do believe the TCPA certainly applies to the Rockport Area Association of Realtors. And, you know, I'll be back to discuss, I think, whether or not they met their burden once it shifted.
Good morning, Your Honors. Troy Bollier with Bertolino LLP. I represent the appellees here today. May it please the court. Your Honors, this case, really the essence of this case, boils down to the importance of statutory language and the limits that it places on the operation and the applicability of the statute in conjunction with the legislature's purpose clause. The statute at 27005B is really what's controlling here, that you have to find that the counterclaim at issue was based on or in response to one of the exercise of these speech, association, or petition rights. And I think it's important to note the statute in 2019 was narrowed. So 27005B previously had broader relates to language, which I'll touch on with some of the case law. But because the appellants in this case are stretching beyond the legitimate bounds of the statute, our contention is the trial court got it right. The trial court determined the motion didn't have merit, and it made a finding that it was frivolous. So we think that this court should affirm the trial court ruling basically for four reasons. The most important, I think, first off, is that the appellants have not met their burden to show by a preponderance of the evidence that the statute applies. That's the first step. If the statute does apply, we believe we've met our burden to show a prima facie case. In any event, the appellants have not demonstrated that any affirmative defense applies. They kind of mentioned it briefly at the trial court and in the appellate briefing. And then finally, we believe that the trial court properly addressed attorney's fees, the request from both parties. So I want to focus most of my time on the applicability of the statute because, like I said, I really think that's where this case rises and falls. And we're talking about three rights, and they're basically defined by statute in 27001. And so when you start off and you first touch on the point of free speech, you're talking about a communication made in connection with a matter of public concern. Not public purpose.
Can I just ask you to directly address Mr. Purnell's when he cited us that portion of the statute, which I failed to write down, 27 point, did someone else write it down besides me? as to where it defined, where he thinks it meets the statute.
Yes, Purnell, Your Honor.
What statute do you recall just very quickly?
27.001. Yes, Your Honor. So sub 7 in the definitional section is the definition of matter of public concern. And as the appellants have conceded, I think there's A, B, and C. A is not at play here.
Right.
B and C we do not believe applies here, Your Honor, because quite simply we don't have something that's of concern to the public. We have internally facing internal management, operations, leadership dispute amongst a small local trade association, not a nationwide one, not even a statewide one, like in the Combined Law Enforcement Associations of Texas case from the Austin Court of Appeals that the appellants cite. This is a local, a small, it's not a major metro area. And they're quintessentially issues that are only of concern to the membership. You know, I would use the HEB survey test. If you went down to the local HEB and you asked five people, do you know what's going on with this local association? They're probably not going to go, no. As opposed to if I say, have you heard lately that the Ken Paxton impeachment trial is going on? Or did you see that former President Trump was indicted? Or are you familiar with the fentanyl crisis in the country? Those are the types of things that are outwardly facing.
I would rely on five people at HEB about knowing any of those matters. But with that being said, I understand your point. But is a realtors association that is to provide some service to the public of Rockport, whether it be a small town or a big town, isn't that a matter of public concern to the people of Rockport?
It could be, Your Honor, but not in the record in this case. And
so you're narrowing it even further down that we have to look at specifically what is being alleged in these emails as to whether that is a public concern.
I think so, Your Honor. I think it says the statute in 2705B says that the claim is based on or in response to one of the exercise of these rights. And I think when you do that, Your Honor, and you look at things, for example, like the Kipp case that the appellants have cited, which I think is misplaced, that was about a nonprofit addressing building a community center, quintessentially externally facing, right? It's going to provide social services, health, educational services, and that's what the court found there. Not the inward-facing, like you said, the limited concerns that only the membership is going to have about their private dues. There's no funding available.
And that was my concern, because in the cases where we were dealing with finances, it was either grant money or taxpayer monies, which, of course, would be a public concern. And these are, my understanding, all private dues.
That's correct, Your Honor. There is nothing in the record that I'm aware of that supports that there's any public funds at issue. And I think that goes to the internal character of the counterclaim that really makes it outside the bounds of the statute. Again, remember the purpose clause in 27.002. Yes, we want to protect constitutional rights, but again, it's under this backdrop of, quote, participation in government. And so you've either got to have this government involvement or this matter of public concern. And we don't see that here in terms of the exercise of the free speech. When you look to the right of association that's also addressed, again, defined in 27001, it again hones in on collectively coming together to promote, pursue, defend, express. We don't see that collectively component occurring. In fact, the record is clear, and I can give you the references here, that Mr. Newman was disclaiming that he was associating. That's at 167, 170, 178, and 186. He says, hey, this is just me. I'm not, you know, as the statute says, joining together to collectively express, promote, pursue, or defend. It's also important to note that, again, the statute was narrowed, and the current version says common interest relating to a governmental proceeding, which we all agree is not here, or a matter of public concern. So, again, we get back to this matter of public concern. Now, the appellants have cited the Combined Law Enforcement Association case of Texas. I think that's misplaced for a couple of reasons. Again, it's a pre-amendment case, so they did rely on the broader relates to language, which I don't think is correct because the statute is based on or in response to. But I also think it's a quintessential public servant case. You've got issues involving government agencies, potential criminal charges in Williamson County, and, you know, the offering of a potential, you know, high-profile job at the Austin Police Department at issue in that case. So, yes, it was an association, but it's an association, again, dealing with external issues that the public would be concerned about. And, again, it's quintessential public servants, police officers. I mean, the nexus between that, especially in the wake of the concerns these days about public policing, couldn't be stronger. So, again, we don't think that there's a basis under the exercise of free speech. We don't see any basis to show a matter of public concern under the associational right. And then lastly, we get to this issue of can we rely on the third right, which is the right to petition? And in that case, the appellants have mainly relied on the judicial proceeding component of the statute. And that's, you know, under the definitional sections 001, it's, you know, 4A sub 1, the communication in or pertaining to a judicial proceeding. And I think that one may be the easiest of all, because what we're talking about here is pre-suit conduct. We're talking about communications, some oral and some written, that occurred in the months prior to the lawsuit. The appellants have cited on page 11 of their brief, both to the Austin and the Dallas Courts of Appeals, and those courts have addressed this pre-suit conduct. In fact, in the Austin Court of Appeals, it's a homeowners association case, and they tried to argue pretty much what's going on here, saying, hey, we think that this pre-suit notice we're required to give under the property code kind of pulls us in across the statutory line and gets us under this judicial proceeding concept. Well, both courts said no. They said, again, back to my theme, look at the plain language of the statute. It doesn't say prospective, future, potential litigation. There needs to be actual existing litigation. And so, again, this counterclaim wasn't because of some kind of exercise of a right. It was because these false defamatory statements were made. And to your point, Your Honor, earlier, while I do think, appellants have cited to kind of the organizational documents for this association, they really have missed the mark, because that's not what we're talking about in this case. It certainly could come into play under the right facts. You know, like you talk about the Kipp case, if the conduct that's at issue, that's based on or in connection to, according to the statute language, were different, I think we'd be there. If the association was talking about a rulemaking activity going on at the Texas Real Estate Commission that licenses license holders, you bet. If they were developing plans for lobbying because of upcoming legislation at the legislature, you know, federal or state, I think, you know, you have a different circumstance. But the problem in this case, when we look through that matter of public concern lens, is that we're internally facing, we're talking about internal management operations, fees that are only paid by the members. It's just a quintessentially private thing that people out in the community don't have a general interest. You know, they don't have a dog in the fight, really. So we think that on that basis, the statute does not apply. The appellants have not met their burden, and that's why the trial court properly ruled. There's no merit to this, and it is frivolous because there's not a basis.
Now, in their brief, they mentioned that they believe that the judge thought the TCPA applied. Can you? I mean, is there evidence of that? Well, because that would mean that it fails on, or you won on the you presented a prima facie case.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that's correct. I think if you look at the transcript, and we've cited this in the brief, the trial court judge during the hearing makes it very clear she's taking everything under submission. She asks for the parties to submit their briefs And again, the ruling from the court is that it's no, there's no merit to it, and a finding that it was frivolous. I don't believe that the trial court would make a finding that it's frivolous if there was some question about whether the statute applied. But again, I think as was discussed earlier, the court's looking at this de novo because you're construing the statute. So again, I think, like I said, that burden is not met by the plaintiffs. We don't get out of stage one. But there are a couple of other points I did want to address, unless the court has any other questions about the applicability.
Are you going to address your attorney's fees?
Yes, Your Honor, I can. Yes, so...
because you're, I'm assuming you're asking us to affirm your attorney's fees.
Yes, Judge, yes. And so really what we're talking about, two things here. First is, obviously, since the court got it right in denying the motion, no fees are allowed under the statute. You have to win on the motion to get fees. I think the other point that's important to remember is there's no evidence of the other side's fees in the record whatsoever. There's no affidavit. There's no documentary evidence. There's no mention of it during the hearing on the transcript. And I think that's important because the rules of appellate procedure are clear that you have to have that evidence. I think that the court decision in the Carter case that we've cited in the brief from the San Antonio Court of Appeals really lays that out about, hey, you have to have some evidence to support fees. And that's consistent with precedents from the Supreme Court. That Carter case from San Antonio was a defamation case, and the movements there actually won. They won their case, but they didn't have any evidence of fees. And the Court of Appeals says, look, you know, the trial judge said they're not going to take any new evidence. You didn't do anything. You know, you didn't make an offer of proof. You didn't file any post-hearing motions or do anything.
Did you submit any evidence of attorney's fees?
Yes, Judge, we did.
Okay.
We did.
That's what I was trying to ascertain
exactly
where it came from.
We submitted our billing statements. They were unobjected to. They were the only evidence in the record, and they're attached to our response to the TCPA motion, which is in the record. And so, obviously, there's some evidence in the record to support that. I think beyond that, it becomes an abuse of discretion question, really, for the court, because the actual amount of fees is an abuse of discretion standard. That's what the case law says. And I think here it was a modest $1,500. I mean, there was obviously more work than that done, but that's within the trial court's sound discretion. And so, you know, it was appropriate. The court made a finding that, hey, this goes beyond the bounds of the statute, basically, by finding it's frivolous and has no merit. And so I'm going to award some fees, and that amount was reasonable. So to my, I think in wrapping up, what I will say is that the court should affirm the trial court's decision on this because the statute just does not apply. We made a prima facie showing. Again, I think there's brief, scant reference to an affirmative defense, but I really don't think that that's been demonstrated. And then, as the court was inquiring, I think there's a legitimate basis in the record for attorney's fees, both for denying the appellant's request, again, because they didn't prevail on the motion and they didn't have any evidence. I would also point out to the court, too, that there was ample opportunity for them to do that because they did file a motion for reconsideration. So it's not like there wasn't post-hearing opportunity for that. You know, the court took the full 30 days almost, I believe, before issuing their order. And again, like I said, the court made a finding that it was frivolous, so that does trigger the statute that they may award attorney's fees, and as we know from the case law, that's an abuse of discretion standard. So unless the court has any other questions, I will end on that note.
I do not.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court again. I wanted to just take it from the end and go back to the beginning, I suppose. On the attorney's fees, the issue is when the responding party wins, the court can award fees. They may, it's not a shall, which is one of the distinctions. The other part is if there's a finding that there's a sanction, or it's a sanction, it's sanctionable conduct because it was frivolous, I believe the code actually requires that the court offer some version of a findings of fact on that. And that never happened in this case. It had to happen within, I think, 30 days. So it's not real clear to me how that holds up on appeal. So that's under 27.007, the additional findings required. Going backwards, though, and talking about whether or not, you know, assuming that the court considers the TCPA to apply in this case, one of the things I wanted to point out is really nothing was addressed at the hearing regarding the evidence that was produced in order to meet the burden of whether or not there's each and every element of the defamation claim had been established. It was sort of touched on at the end of the hearing. The briefing, though, is really where you would find this evidence, and you're instructed to look to the pleadings and as well as the affidavits that are submitted. Notably, no affidavit has been submitted in this case. The only thing that was submitted were these emails, and then the sort of conclusory statements in the pleadings. That's not enough to support each and every one of the elements. So just on that alone, beyond the fact that, you know, the emails weren't proved up, but, you know, I'm going to move on from that. It's just more, do they state how it is that this was a defamatory statement that was published and that they were damaged? There are three people that apparently are alleging that they were defamed. They haven't shown us how they were damaged, other than this broad conclusory statement that, well, we've had to deal with this and take calls and it's taken time away from our business. They certainly don't say what they've lost or what the amounts of those damages are. And it's just a straight defamation claim. The pleadings are only as to defamation. It's not a defamation per se counterclaim. So they have to provide some evidence. So I think they just fail on that alone. And if you do want to look at those emails, you'd see that the statements are not defamatory. They just don't arise to that level. So and really, they're just factual statements made by Mr. Newman. But getting back to, I think the real issue here is whether or not the TCPA applies. I do believe it does apply. I think the difference, you know, in this case, that really is just fatal to this, the concept that the TCPA does not apply, is that their stated purpose is that they're outwardly facing. They're servicing the community, which I think is incredibly important when you're analyzing this case. Also, I do believe that this counterclaim was in response to an exercise of the right to petition. The emails had been sent before. There had been conversations back and forth about please stop this, you know, that sort of stuff. But it was not until the DEC action was filed that they filed the defamation claim. I think it was, you know, sort of really just a reaction to receiving the DEC action. It was an attempt to really just silence Mr. Newman further. In this case, silence his exercise to the right of petition. Otherwise, I believe this is all a public purpose, what the Rockport Area Association of Realtors does. I think it's disingenuous to suggest that they're not there serving the public. And that each one of the communications were Mr. Newman's attempt to associate and exercise his right of association, gather people around, let's move forward, let's make this a better organization for the people, and his right of free speech. And he's simply criticizing them for the way they're managing the finances, the way they're handling the MLS, and the way they're essentially, you know, running the Rockport Area Association of Realtors, which, as their stated objective is extremely outward-facing and really only outward-facing, either because of the realtors themselves or the home ownership and property ownership in the Aransas area community. But other than that, Your Honors, I appreciate the time. If you don't have any questions, I will surrender my last second.
Thank you for that. Anything further from the panel?
No.
No, we are good.